Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women. Today's guest is Toni Alika Hickman, and Toni has quite a life to share with us. Toni, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Toni, I'd like to start with sort of your beginnings before we talk in more detail about the aneurysms that you actually experienced and survived. But first, tell us where you were born.
I was born in New York and raised in New Orleans.
Born in New York and raised in New Orleans.
Right.
When did you move to New Orleans?
Roughly around 7 years old.
Okay. So your first 6 years or so was the press of New York City, and then it was the press of New Orleans.
Yes.
Both kind of busy places to live in.
Yes, and totally the same and different at the same time.
Yeah, I would think so. What was the biggest difference for you between, if there is one or two that you can identify, between New York and New Orleans?
New York is just like super crowded, so it's always somebody on the street. I don't care what time of night it is, it's somebody always on the street. And it's just a busy energy in New York that I really do like. And New Orleans is more like cultural, and, you know, they celebrate death. It had more, culture. That's the word I can use.
Okay.
Yeah.
The biggest difference is the culture of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you moved to New Orleans. You were about 7 years old. What were your early childhood experiences like? Who was in the household that you grew up in? And tell us about school and friends. What was going on?
Well, I was raised with my mom for a brief second. My mom and my dad moved to Atlanta, and I stayed there maybe like a year or two before we went to New Orleans.
Okay.
And they split up, and so I ended up, you know, staying with my mom. And so I'm my mom's only child, and it was just, you know, me and her. And sometimes I would stay with other relatives, but for the most part, you know, it was just me and her. So.
And would you say that your growing up years in New Orleans with just you and your mom, were they happy?
They were filled.
Okay.
I mean, you know, my mom went through her own thing with life and, you know, being a single mom and making sure that she had everything covered as far as our bills are concerned. You know, she wasn't home a lot. And so, you know, that's just what happened. And I appreciate her for sacrificing herself, you know, for our household. So, I mean, sometimes I would think I rebelled against her a lot because I just hated the fact that she was gone. And then there were times where I had to stay with other people a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, you know, I had a lot of frustration. But, you know, I understand that she was just doing what she knew to do. And so, you know, that's the reality.
You know, the fact is, of course, as you've just described, that being a single parent or being the child of a single parent, I mean, they are both kind of filled with their own challenges. And yes, as a young one growing up, if you've got one parent in the house and that parent is not there, then it's really hard. It's hard.
Yeah, exactly.
For you, as you were growing up as a teenager, did you have any ideas about who or what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be on stage and singing and all of that at a young age. My mom, she used to go to a Seventh-day Adventist church, and I was in the choir, and I was always leading and singing, and I just really enjoyed it. And In my spare time, I was also always like a poet. I would write poetry. And I guess when I was in middle school, I got into a talent show, and a friend of mine, my best friend at the time, and her cousin, he wrote a rap for us, and it was about an hour later, and we had a beatbox on stage, and we won like first place. And that was when I was just like, ah, oh, I could turn my poetry into rap, and there we go.
And
So
the rap was about now or let now the candy?
the
Sounds like a reasonable thing to do a rap about. And
it was so awesome. Yeah, I still remember the rap. So yeah,
do
it
you want
was
to share it
awesome.
with us or do you want to not?
Yeah, I can share it.
Okay.
It was I only remember part of it, so I just share what I remember.
Okay.
But it was one day I was starving just like a gator, warming and craving for some now or laters. Went to the door to the candy store, and what did I see? Now or laters, good Lord. Just to have one in my mouth and take a taste, it would make me get funky and rock the place. It was an orange, a blue, and then a red. All sorts of colors running through my head. Okay, and that's
That's
pretty much
what, now I got to run out and find some now or laters. I don't even know if they still make them. Oh my goodness. And you were like 9 years old at the time?
No, I was in middle school, so
Okay.
I was more like 12.
12.
Yeah.
What was interesting was to hear you say that, even as a young one, you knew that you wanted to be on the stage and knew you wanted to perform. So many children at that age, as I know you know, are terrified about being on stage. But it sounded like
Right.
you really blossomed on stage.
Yeah. It was and still is my favorite place.
So life was moving along. Walk us through the as you went through middle school and high school, what kinds of things were you doing to realize your stage dreams?
Well, like I said, my mom was never home. So at one point, I became a knucklehead. I was always a tomboy. And so I was hanging in the streets a lot. And so I had a DJ or a person that would work with me and make beats for me. And my mom, I was, like I said, I was a knucklehead. And at one point, I actually dropped out of school, and my mom kicked me out, but she didn't kick me out and like put me on the street. She kicked me out and paid my first month's rent, and she told me, if you want to be independent and doing all this, then you figure out how you're going to pay your bills and do it yourself, you know. And I appreciate her doing that, because that was when I started really like waking up, but I also started coming into my music, and I went through my own trials in life that I had, like I had some serious lessons. But my music was the one thing that saved me. Like, I used to hang around a lot of, drug dealers and all of that stuff, and I've watched my friends get killed and all of that. But through all of that, I started learning more about life, and then my message and my music started changing. And so that was the main thing that I kind of went through, even in high school, like, because I dropped out and I went back and all of that stuff. But I remember in high school, like, that being a big memory is making sure that like my music was a part of everything I did. So
It sounds like in some ways the music was perhaps your lifeline to the rest of your world.
yeah, it really was. It was. That's a perfect way to word it.
The experience of dropping out and then going back to high school, how was that for you when you returned?
It was cool. I mean, it was, it wasn't a long time.
Okay.
It wasn't a long time, and then I dropped out again, and I dropped out for a long time, and I actually ended up getting my GED. because like I said, I was going through my own growing pains.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my mom, she was having her own growing pains. And, you know, I don't, it's not my place to speak on her life, but,
sure.
you know, she had some things that she was going through and dealing with my father and his absence and all of that stuff. And so,
so you were
you
both
know, life just kind of
you were both kind of struggling with living your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, and my mom, she she's an educated woman. She's worked for the Chamber of Commerce, Better Business Bureau. She has degrees for days. She's a very wise woman, and at the same time, you know, she had to step away because sometimes the stress of I guess being a single parent and
sure.
doing everything she was doing just got to her, you know? And so I don't know. It was really interesting. And in the meantime, I was not helping because I was being a knucklehead. So but I like I said, I dropped out eventually for good and started getting into trouble. And I remember the police coming up on me, and they was just like, we've been watching you, and, you know, I just want you to know we've been watching you.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah, and so after that, that was it for me. And I just said, okay, you know what? I'm about to change my life. And the next day, I went and applied for a job, and I was still on my own, and I moved out of the place because I had roommates, and then I moved out of the place that I was staying and moved into my own place. And my producer, who had been with me through all of this, he would come and sleep at the couch sometimes or whatever. And eventually, after all of that, I decided that I wanted to go to New York and look for a deal for my music. And I had an associate that, you know, we would perform together at different places in
mm-hmm.
New Orleans. And she had a song on the radio, her and another girl. And I told her I was going to New York, and she's like, I want to go too. And so we both went up there. And am I going too fast?
No, not at all. But I'm
okay.
when you said you went to New York, did you have a plan for New York, or did you just decide
to go?
Yeah, I was
going to get a deal. And
okay.
I had an aunt that lived there, so I was going crash in her house and get a deal. I was just that determined. And so the young lady I told you, she came with me, and after about a month there, like, we had met some people because the young lady had a cousin that lived there who was signed to Motown.
Okay.
And so when we went out there, after a minute, like, we got on my aunt's nerves too. And so she never told us, but, you know, it started being obvious.
Okay.
And so we went to a shelter, the Covenant House.
Okay.
We went and stayed in the shelter.
And Covenant House is very well known.
Yeah. And
how, let me ask you,
how
was that experience for you? I mean, certainly that's not what you went to New York to do. So how did that impact you? How were you feeling as you were staying there?
Well, it was, I went through a lot of emotions there too, because like, after a couple of days that I had gotten there, you know, my stuff got stolen. And then the young lady I came to New York with, she ended up going to stay with her cousin who was signed to Motown. But I couldn't stay there. And so I was just kind of at the shelter, you know. And so I had a lot of animosity and anger on my heart. On top of them, looking around and like, all of these people have stolen my stuff. And so I would call my mom on the line, and I'd be like, Mommy, you know, stole my stuff. And my mom would just be like, baby, you can come home. Just know you can come home. And my whole thing was, if I come home, then that means I did everything for nothing. Mm-hmm. So it would be a wasted trip if I don't get what I came out here for.
Gotcha.
So nothing would let me leave, even though I should, like, that would have been the smarter. I don't know if it would have been the, no, it wouldn't have been the smarter. It would have been the easier thing for me to do is go back home, you know, and, but I didn't, and I stayed, and I eventually, the people at the Covenant House just really started loving me, and they helped me get a place of my own. It was like a halfway house situation.
Okay. How long were you at the Covenant House?
About 3 months.
Okay. And they helped you, and they helped you to move forward in your life.
Yes, because you have counselors there. When you're there, you have these counselors that you can go talk to if you're stressed out or, you know, they help you because the goal is to get everybody to be independent.
Okay.
And they helped me reach that. Them and my mom. Like I said, my mom is so resourceful and so and full of wisdom. And so between her working with my counselor, they helped find me a place, and it was like a halfway house type thing.
Okay.
It was decent. It was like a, you know, it was an efficiency. So I had a kitchen, I had a shower.
Okay.
And all of that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And while all of that was going on, and that's stressful, what mm-hmm. was happening with your music?
So, in between that, me and the girl still got back together. We would talk back and forth, but, you know, it wasn't as strong. So anyway, started working with different producers in New York. And then, okay, so Jive Records, we started dealing with them.
Okay.
And then Jive Records, they wanted to give us a deal, a demo deal or something. But then another group came, and they thought that they were more marketable than us because I'm like 6 feet tall, and the girl I rapped with was 5 feet or 4'11".
Okay.
So we were like, you know, on camera, it was horrible. And so so they got a group that came in that was female that was a better mix than us. And so... you know, that was one blow, but it wasn't the only thing. And my thing was just keep going. Eventually we'll find, you know, what we're looking for. And so, but through Jive, I went to the girl that was my partner. Eventually she went back to New Orleans and I stayed in New York. And I went back to New Orleans just to visit my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was visiting her, this company that we were supposed to do music through Jive called my mom's house, and they were just like, well, what happened to y'all? We didn't hear what happened. And you know, I told them, I said, well, this is what happened.
Uh-huh.
You know, they found another group or whatever, but this was a big independent group. They had, you know, people who had put out gold and platinum albums.
Okay.
And so they was like, well, you still got the other girl? And I was like, yeah, I can call her. So I called her on the line. And then the owner of the company got on the phone, and he wanted to hear us rap. And so we did it.
Right there on the phone?
Right on the phone, three-way.
Okay.
And right after we did it, the next day they flew us to Houston.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of us doing a deal with a company that is called Suave House, which has produced gold and platinum albums a lot. So,
and so for the, I mean, you know, that whole experience says so much. I mean, for one company, the height was a problem, the height difference was a problem. For another company, no problem whatsoever. And you know, it really speaks to the need to, if you've got a dream, you really want to hold on to your dream as much as you can. Tony, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue and learn more about your dream. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk here on Women's Wednesday. We'll be back in a moment. And we are returning to continue the conversation with Tony. Tony, the idea that you had so many sort of fits and starts just in terms of what was going on in your life, and yet you continued, you knew that music was your life, and you didn't let anything or anyone stop you.
Right.
So tell us about, you'd now signed on with Suave Records, so life was good, right?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, we traveled all throughout the United States. We performed and, you know, all of that. It was cool, and it started to be an awakening to just different lessons that needed to be learned about the music business. So, but it was one of the best experiences I've had in my life.
Tony, I'm going to ask you to speak directly into your phone. Because
sorry, I still have you on. Oh, my apologies. Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, that's much better. So I'm just going to ask you to tell us what some of those lessons were that you learned as you were working with Suave Records.
Well, one of the things was, well, this is what happens with artists that have never been signed to a major label. They are so excited that they may finally make it that they don't really pay attention to the business side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was a mistake for me. But I'm not mad at it because the experience was still amazing. But even while I was signed and being featured on gold and platinum albums, I still was like working and having money handed to me from the CEO. And, you know, it shouldn't have been that way. I should have been receiving checks in my name.
Right.
But I didn't know that. So, you know, a contract is given to you always in the person's favor that is issuing it, not in, you know,
in the artist's favor.
In your favor.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's never going to be in your favor unless you adjust it. But I wanted to make sure that, you know, we were straight. And that was a lesson. And I mean, we had lawyers, and our lawyers actually, you know, told us, hey, you don't give your publishing away and all of this. But the fear of losing this opportunity bypassed, you know, the lawyer. And so we had to learn. And like I said, I'm grateful. I don't really have any anger toward the CEO or anything because, you know, he did what was in his best interest. And I just didn't do what was in mine. And, you know, that's just what happened. But I'm grateful that he did put me out there. And, you know, people still know who I am even to this day that I, you know, they used to listen to Swild House. So
let me ask you this just about the music business, because what you're saying, you know, in a lot of ways, it sounds like you did everything right. You had a contract, you had an attorney look at it, and then you didn't pay attention to what the attorney said.
I didn't take the advice. No, not me or my partner. We both didn't, because we're looking at, hey, okay, we have to just take losing our publishing and losing our rights versus losing this opportunity as a deal. Then we went for the deal, and mm-hmm. it was ignorant on our part. It was very ignorant on our part, but, you know, we did it.
You didn't
and a
know.
A lot of artists did it.
Yeah.
I wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say to somebody now who's starting out in a career, what would you want them to look out for themselves?
I would say be wise, and, you know, I would tell them to, like, really listen to the lawyers.
Okay.
Because you don't learn. See, once you get over that buzz of, oh, my God, I'm about to be famous and I'm about to be, you know, making a lot of money, once you get over that, then the reality sets in. It's almost like I don't know, it's like a drug or something. You know, you just think, okay, we've made it, and nothing is going to come in us in between us making it. So, and that's what record companies really, they get paid off of our ignorance, you know.
It's true. I mean, I think of just countless numbers of artists, you know, certainly from years back. But again, the same kinds of issues confront artists today.
Right.
You gotta look out for yourself.
I mean, and if even artists as big as Prince, Jay-Z, all of these artists will tell you they went through the same exact thing.
Okay.
Now, would they trade that situation? Jay-Z said he wouldn't, you know, look at where he is now, you know. So it's just something that comes in the business and you have to make a choice.
At the point that you became aware of the fact that being paid cash wasn't exactly the thing that ought to be happening, what else was going on in your life?
Well, at this time, also, I had, started separating from my label mate, my partner at the time. And so we had started separating. We was doing different features by ourselves and all of that stuff. And eventually I became the only artist on that label. On another side, the most popular artists that were on the label, A Baller MJG, they were going through their own issues with the label. And they started doing a lawsuit. Basically the same thing I'm telling you. And
okay.
So our rent, all of the artists, the rent was paid by the CEO or the company. And one by one, the artists started losing their places. And, you know, this is what I have to say. That's why I say I don't have any ill feelings toward the CEO.
Uh-huh.
Because when everybody else's rent wasn't paid, my rent was still paid.
Okay.
And it gave me an opportunity to get my stuff together, you know. So that is what I appreciate. And, you know, I wouldn't take that away for anything, because it just showed that I was still valued. But, yeah, that was one of the biggest things. And eventually they ended up moving me to Atlanta because they were going to start a whole new company called Swive House Atlanta.
Okay. And so they physically, literally moved you to Atlanta. And
yes.
How was that?
And me and my mom were separated, like, you know, different cities for so long. And so when I told her they were moving me to Atlanta, she moved to Atlanta so we could be closer together again. And go ahead.
So how was that, with living closer to your mom?
It was one of the best. We're still close. My mom is like 10 minutes away from me in Houston. I will never leave the same city with her again. She has to come with.
Does she know that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She knows.
Okay, as long
she
as
knows.
She knows. All right. So all of this time, what's your health like during all of these experiences? Do you feel like you're
fine?
In good health? Okay. Health was fine.
I was raised as a vegetarian because I don't know if you're familiar with Seventh-day Adventists.
Yes.
But Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarians. They teach you about not eating meat and, you know, all of this stuff. So I was raised as a vegetarian. My blood pressure was fine. I never had any issues. And I was fine.
But then came a time when you weren't fine.
Yes.
What happened?
And so this is after I moved to Atlanta. And I moved to Atlanta and I met a wonderful man. At the time, he was wonderful in my eyes.
Okay.
But anyway, I met him and he was Nigerian. And we fell in love and I had the most beautiful blessing to me, which is my son. And I had him. And shortly after I had him, he might have been like four.
Okay.
He was about four. I was performing at this time. By this time, I got out of the deal with Swive House. Swive House kind of started going down after that.
Okay.
And I got out of that deal and I was working with Jagged Edge, Jazzy Faye, all of these people. And performing in magazines for days in Atlanta, all of that. And I had my first brain aneurysm.
You had your first brain aneurysm. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I didn't even know what a brain aneurysm was until it happened. And so I was at my mom's house at the time, and she said I was acting strange. I remember parts of this because I was, like, non-responsive a little bit. Like, she'll ask me questions, and it seemed like I had an attitude or something because I was just, like, one-word answers and looking dull. And she said my son actually acknowledged it and was just like, what's wrong with mommy, you know? And then she asked me, she said, you want to go to the doctor? And I just said, yes. And we hospital hopped until they found somebody that had a bed, and they realized that I was having a brain aneurysm.
Okay, one second. You hospital hopped? Are you saying that the first hospital you went to,
they didn't have a bed?
Well, how?
And they wouldn't operate because they didn't have a bed. So they sent me from hospital. I went to two hospitals before I got to Emory. And Emory is the one that had a bed and operated.
And that's Emory in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me ask you this. When you went to the first hospital, your mom drove, you didn't go by an ambulance. Mom drove?
No, we went, no, it was an ambulance.
Okay.
And my mom followed the ambulance.
So the ambulance folks, I mean, the paramedics, did they understand what was going on with you or no?
I guess they had died. You know what? That's a good question. I'm going to ask my mom.
Okay.
Because I'm assuming that they diagnosed what was going on, but I guess they figured they had me under control. I don't know. That's a good question. But I know that the first hospital they went to would not accept me, and then they went to Grady, and Grady would not accept me because they said they didn't have any operating beds or something like that. And so they went directly to Emory, and Emory is the one that took me in. What they did is called an angiogram. Are you familiar with that?
Describe that to us.
Well, it's basically they put this fluid in your body, and then it's like, I guess it highlights your organs or whatever.
Okay.
And then they went through my groin area with something like a camera. And also, this is what I still have a debate with Emory. So they told my mom that they clamped the aneurysms with the angiogram thingy.
Okay.
But that's the only sort of surgery that they did. They went through my groin area. And so after I healed from that one, I was out for like 3 to 6 months. It's blurry. Because I had extreme back pain from that. I don't know why, but I just remember having bad back pain.
So for that, you were out for 3 to 6 months. You had the angiogram.
Out of work.
Out of work. So you had the angiogram, and then they sent you home. Mm-hmm. And then what was that like for you? What did you have any residual symptoms in addition to the back pain?
No, it was mainly back pain. That's what I remember the most. It's just having back pain.
Okay. And mm-hmm. in dealing with the back pain, how were you guided to treat that?
Well, see, they gave me medicine to take. I had to take something called Dilantin.
Okay.
It was like 500 milligrams or something, but when I took it, it made me feel like I was about to have a heart attack. And so I called my doctor. No, I went and saw my doctor. I was like, I'm taking this medicine, but it is really making me feel like I'm about to have a heart attack. Like, mm-hmm. can you do something about it? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, you know, if I was in your situation and I had an aneurysm, I'd just be happy to be alive, and you just have to take the medicine.
Oh. Okay, that's an interesting response.
Yeah, it was. But I went home and I was like, I'm not taking this medicine anymore. He's trying to kill me. So I stopped taking the medicine. I took myself off because when I laid, it felt like my heart was about to detach from whatever it's attached to in my body. That's how serious it was. And I just stopped because it was not comfortable. So
when you stopped taking the medication, how did that affect you?
It didn't do anything. It made me feel better. Okay. I stopped taking it and I felt better. And that was enough sign for me.
Okay.
So and I eventually just, you know, became medicine free again. And like I said, I've never had high blood pressure, never had any issues besides this.
The aneurysm.
So going further, go ahead.
Did anyone explain to you how it is that you actually had an aneurysm? Could they give you any understanding?
I asked the doctor, right. And so I asked the doctor and I'm like, well, why is this happening? Like, what, you know, why did this happen? And he said, well, you know, they don't know why aneurysms happen. And that was it. And that's the only answer I've gotten. And then I've gotten answers other than that. It's like it could be something that I was born with in my head. And I'll tell you what I found out after my second brain aneurysm.
When did you have the second one?
It was like 3 years later.
Okay.
And I was, of course, doing my music. And I had finished my album. I had teamed up with another label, and me and this person was going to put up. I had my own label, and he had his. And we was going to tie our sources together and put out my project. And
So things were going well. Things were really going well.
I mean, after I got back into it, I got back on stage. I started getting so much publicity. People were waiting on me to come back out.
Okay.
And like I said, I went to New Orleans to celebrate. I was with my boyfriend at the time. By this time, me and my son's father are separate. We're done.
Okay.
And but I was with my other one, my boyfriend at the time.
Okay.
And his mom lived in New Orleans, and so we went there to celebrate. And I'm eating. She had made some fried rice, and I was eating it, and all of a sudden, I started vomiting. Now, that was my symptoms with my first brain aneurysm, too.
Okay.
But I'm thinking in my head, there is no way. I had never heard of a brain aneurysm, let alone a person having it twice. So in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, I have food poisoning because there's absolutely no way I'm having another brain aneurysm.
Okay. And in fact, so you were having another brain aneurysm.
I was having another brain aneurysm, and that one started leaking in my head. So I eventually passed out and woke up in Tulane Medical Hospital. My mom was in Atlanta and with my son. And so they had to drive from Atlanta to New Orleans to give the doctors permission to cut my head open and operate on me. And
Tony,
so she came.
Tony, I'm going to interrupt you.
Okay.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I would like to continue right here, and so that's what we'll do. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer.
Okay.
You're listening to Mind Talk. You're listening to Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. We'll return in a moment. Tony, the second aneurysm, you began, you were nauseous, you were vomiting. What else was going on, if anything else, at that time? Did you have any other symptoms in addition to that?
Yeah, I was stressed out. I was stressed out because I was arguing with my boyfriend. I was arguing with him a lot. And but yeah, I just couldn't stop vomiting. And so we ended up sleeping at his sister's house, and I would constantly go in the bathroom and vomit and then come back and get in the bed. And I was told I passed out in the bathroom.
So still, even with all of that, because you were pretty clear that this was not a repeat of what you had experienced 3 years before.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking still it was
food poisoning.
Food poisoning.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So clearly, you know, one of the things that it speaks to is don't self-diagnose.
Right.
You wound up at Tulane Hospital, and you were operated on at that point.
No, I wasn't operated on. Yeah. Uh-huh.
What? Tell us about that experience at the hospital.
Well, I was kind of telling me what happened because I had family in New Orleans too. So, you know, they came eventually when they found out where I was. But I was told that, you know, I was just like in and out of consciousness. And, you know, they shaved my head, so they prepped me for surgery. But I think they had to wait until my mom got there.
I see.
And so when she got there, you know, she gave them permission, and they told her it's a 50-50 chance she may not come out of this. And if she does, you know, she may not be able to speak or whatever. We can't say how it's going to come out. And my mom just was like, operate on her.
Okay.
And so they operated. And while I was on the table, I guess my body went into shock because I had a stroke while they were in my head.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And that's what changed my life.
How did that change your life?
Well, when I came to, I was I couldn't speak, I couldn't walk, and I couldn't even add or say water. I wanted water so bad because I had tubes up my nose, down my throat, and my mouth was dry, and I couldn't eat anything. And I was just like, I want water. And then, but they couldn't, this is what I'm thinking in my head, but they couldn't understand me.
Okay.
And so my mom gave me a tablet. And so my left side, it wasn't paralyzed. It was weak, but it wasn't paralyzed.
Okay.
And so I tried to write out what I was saying, but she said I wrote my W like a M, and you know, it just, it wasn't the same. And so that was my story. And the doctors told my mom, or they suggested to my mom to put me in a nursing home because it wasn't likely that I would ever speak or walk again.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Your mom, I can't even begin to imagine what your mom went through at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. She was so strong, though. She's an amazing woman, and she was so strong. Even I hear this from my family, and they were just like, you know, they were wondering why, you know, she wasn't losing it because everybody else was losing it.
Understandable.
Yeah, and she said she knew that if I came back with a solid mind, that I would be okay, because since a baby, I have always been stubborn, and even when the doctors pushed my legs, I pushed very hard back, and the doctors told her that I was going to have a strong constitution. So she knew that if I came back with my mind, that I would be okay, and she kept that thought. She didn't want to think anything else. And
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And how did your mom send you to a nursing home for recovery, or did
no,
she bring
not
you home?
At all.
Okay.
Not at all. No, she refused. But I went to rehabilitation, and after a couple of days in the hospital, like, the nurses immediately started trying to get me to stand up on my own,
uh-huh.
and, you know, all of that. I had to use the bathroom in a bucket. I mean, not a bucket, but you know those things that
yeah, the bedpan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the bedpan. There you go. And so I had to use the bathroom in that. And they would come in my room and make me sit on the side of the bed, and they would pull me up and make me sit back down and all that. So immediately they started trying to really get me to move.
Okay.
And I was receptive. I wanted to move. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, oh, my God, what happens, you know, from here? And so they ended up putting me in a rehabilitation unit of the hospital. Well, and I stayed there for like 4 months. I was in a wheelchair.
Mm.
My right arm was literally just lifeless, and it hung over the wheelchair so much so it pulled my arm out of socket.
Oh, my word.
And I had to get something to pull my arm back in place, and it's still not 100%, but I had to get something to pull my arm back in place, and it was a journey.
It sounds like
yeah.
it. And you were there for 4 months.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
your life when you returned home from the rehab facility was what? What was it like?
Oh, it was totally different. I had to go through a lot of emotional change, because if you was to see me, I'm like 6 feet tall. I was the girl who had the weave down in my butt, and you know, high heels on, and all of this. I was a diva, like, and I modeled on the side, like, I, you know, that's who I was. I was commercial beauty.
Okay.
That's who I was. And now I had to define myself, because not only did I not have my hair, I was told I couldn't put chemicals in my hair for at least 1 or 2 years. And,
really?
You know, yeah. And so I'm looking at this whole situation. And even if we had to go to the store, like my mom, I would send my mom or my son in the store for me. And
you didn't want to go in yourself?
I didn't want to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want anybody to ever see me, you know, ever.
That sounds
because
so painful, Toni.
It was painful.
And so different from how you thought of yourself prior to the aneurysm, and certainly how you thought of your life professionally. So very different.
Right.
You loved being on
right.
stage, and now you didn't want
right.
anyone to see you.
Right. Yeah. And see, even when I was in the hospital, I would have my pity parties, you know. And so I can remember, because this is after I started talking again, and one of my nurses came in my room, and I was crying. And she was like, why are you crying? And I said, I'm just trying to understand what is happening to me. I was like,
sure.
You know, I just went through this, and it happens again. And, you know, I was mad at God. I was mad at everybody, because I'm like, okay, why would this keep happening to me? And she said something that, and I say this even when I speak for, you know, myself or for other organizations. She said, the question you really need to ask is, how come you had 2 brain aneurysms and a stroke, and you are still alive?
Huh.
And, you know, that at that time I wasn't trying to hear it, but I still remember her words. And, you know, to this day, those words have kept me sound.
What is your answer to that question today?
I have purpose. I have purpose, and the direction that I was going was not my purpose. My voice still has purpose. It still has meaning. And it is to elevate and inspire even my limp. You know, I don't know why I'm getting emotional now, but
Well, you know, you certainly have been through more than your fair share, and maybe you're getting emotional because this is hard to talk about, and you're allowed.
Right. But, you know, my purpose is to inspire. And even after I finished, you know, with therapy and I came out of my shell because, like I said, I was told I couldn't put any chemicals in my hair. And then my hair had grown long enough to get braids. So I got braids. And then when I took the braids out, I was looking in the mirror. And I was like, you know what? This is me. Mm. Like, all of me. This is my hair. This is my body and the way it is. And I have to love me. And I think that's what was the beginning of me learning to love myself beyond the beauty.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely. As you speak to us today, right now, you are still a rap artist.
Yeah.
You are still doing that thing that you love. You're still
and
writing
I'm an
poetry.
Author. Yeah, and I put a book out, and I'm working on my second book. I'm actually almost done to getting my naturopathic certification. So, yeah.
And you created something called People Pleaser.
Right.
What is that?
That is a song. Everybody has been through it. We live in a society, and it fits to the whole story that I'm telling you, why I didn't want to go in the stores, mm-hmm. why I didn't want to be seen, because we live in a society that paints a false picture of perfection, and it's not real. It's an illusion.
Right.
And you know, we always try and fit into these people's ideas of what we should be and who we should be, and we need to go in ourselves and understand who we should be. And so the song is about not being a people pleaser and really just, you know, working on being your best self.
And, you know, if we just as a planet were able to embrace that philosophy, really different place we'd be living in.
I know. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You've mentioned several times that you were told not to allow any chemicals in your hair. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What was that about?
Yeah, that's why I wrote a book on it. I researched it, but basically they didn't want the chemicals to seep into, I guess, the cut that I had in my head.
Okay.
Or the area that was infected. But for me, it was beyond that, because I was just like, why do I need to stop putting chemicals in my head? And so I researched why. And I found out about lotions, deodorant, toothpaste, pretty much a lot of the things that we use for beauty and how it can contribute to disease.
Mm.
But one of the biggest lessons that I learned, which is why I am assuming they told me this, is that our skin absorbs 60% of everything that we put on it into our bloodstream. And so if I am putting a chemical on my skin that could possibly cause more damage, and it's going directly to my bloodstream, then that's a problem.
A huge problem. 60%
yeah.
is absorbed.
60% of everything we put on our skin is absorbed into our body.
What is the name of the book you wrote?
It's called Chemical Suicide, Death by Association.
Chemical Suicide. And
yes.
And is that book readily available at your website?
It's on my website.
Okay. Why don't we take a moment and get that website information?
Okay. It's www.TonyHickman.com.
Okay, that's TonyHickman, TonyHickman.com.
Yes.
Tony, you have been such an inspiration as you have so graciously shared your story and, quite frankly, your tears with us. And I am very appreciative of your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony, I have to tell you that I am very clear that those who are listening have also been as moved by your strength and your power and your struggle as I have been. So once again, I have to say thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I didn't know I was going to come on your show and cry. So,
well, you share a gift with us, and I do appreciate that, and I do honor that. And folks, I want to thank you for joining us on this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health or other professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. For more information about Mind Talk, please go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And again, the website for Tony is TonyHickman.com. And folks, please always remember, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.